Good morning, Colorado. You're listening to the Daily Sunup. The Daily Sunup podcast is a conversation with the Colorado Sun. See our trust indicators at coloradosun.com/ethics. It's Thursday, June 27th. Today, Colorado Sun environment reporter Michael Booth looks at wind energy's contribution to the state's electrical grid, while health reporter John Engeld provides the latest update on bird flu. Before we begin, want to breathe easier this summer? Take simple steps for better air and help reduce harmful ground-level ozone in your Front Range community. Learn more at simplestepsbetterair.org. Now, let's go back in time with some Colorado history. Byron White, Colorado's first native Supreme Court justice, served his final day on June this day in 1993. Born in Fort Collins in 1917, White excelled as a scholar-athlete at the University of Colorado, earning the nickname Whizzer White for his football prowess. He later graduated from Yale Law School, served in the Navy, and worked as a lawyer. Appointed Deputy Attorney General by President Kennedy, White joined the Supreme Court in 1962. Known for his conservative rulings, he dissented in Miranda v. Arizona and Roe v. Wade, yet tended liberal in civil rights cases. White retired in 1993 and passed away in 2002. Neil Gorsuch, a former clerk of White, was appointed to the Supreme Court in 2017. Before we continue, as a locally owned business, Applewood prides itself on delivering exceptional plumbing, heating, and electrical services to the people of Colorado. Their team of licensed and certified professionals will tackle any home comfort issues you might have, as they always have for 50 years. Because when you choose Applewood, you're not just investing in their services, but also their employees and families. You're investing back into your community. Applewood Plumbing, Heating, and Electric. Locally owned, family operated for 50 years. Learn more at applewoodfixit.com. Next, our feature story.
Hey, everybody. Happy Thursday to you all. I'm John Engeld. I'm the healthcare reporter here at the Colorado Sun. And regular listeners of the Sun Up know that Thursdays are the days that I get together with my colleague, Michael Booth, and we talk about all the work we've been doing on healthcare and also climate and environment reporting. It's Mike's side. So, hey, Mike.
Hey, John. How are you?
I'm doing well. Trying to avoid the heat.
Yes, it's brutal. Lots of ozone high alert days out there, so everybody should keep track of that if they have anybody with asthma issues or other air issues.
So I know my air conditioning has been running pretty steadily for the last few days, and that obviously is going to end up showing up on my electric bills. So I have some questions for you about where all this electricity is coming from in these hot summers. But first, I want to tell people or remind people, if you didn't get a chance to watch our panel this week that was on mental health and how to create a better mental health system here in Colorado. It was moderated by our excellent equity reporter, Tatiana Flowers. And if you didn't get a chance to watch it live, you can still watch it on either our website or our YouTube page. So you can Google Colorado Sun YouTube and you'll see it there. Or you can go to coloradosun.com/events. And if you scroll down a little bit, there'll be videos of previous events and you can watch it there. But a really excellent panel discussion on how to help people, prevent people from falling through the cracks in the system, and well worth your time if you're interested in mental health care policy. So, Mike, let's turn now to that electrical question, that electricity question. And you did some interesting reporting this week on exactly how much wind power is contributing to our electric grid now. So why don't you explain that?
Yeah, we thought it was time to explain to people exactly what you mentioned about where is that electricity coming from that powers your air conditioning on 97 degree days in Colorado, of which we've had quite a few too many lately. And also because it's coming up in politics, one can only hope that the debate gets as deep into these issues as we can. But former President Trump has been very critical of windmills in the last couple of years, actually. Sometimes he talks about all of it as just kind of the silly thing that can't possibly replace America's industrial electrical power and really perform the way it needs to be. Other times he talks about it being a problem for whales with noise if they are ocean-based windmills. Other times he mentions how aesthetically unpleasing they are, especially if they're in front of golf courses that he may happen to own in Scotland. But lots of criticism, some of it valid. And then there are people on the Biden administration side who are huge proponents of renewable energy and windmills and solar power and other forms of renewable energy. And they come in for criticism, too, for the amount of subsidies that they've given to renewable power and the way that they've pushed this transition from coal and fossil fuels into renewable energy that, unless you plan for it, is not quite as reliable as fossil fuels that could be flipped on with a switch. So we decided to look at what's the reality. You can have your political disagreements about subsidies and aesthetic values of windmills and things like that. But what is the reality in Colorado of whether wind is actually working? And these pie charts that we ran with the help of our great graphics and social media person, Danica, are pretty telling because you look at 2001 first. That was the year that we decided to go back to as kind of a benchmark when Colorado's grid started to change quite a bit. And the pie chart is almost all dark coal. 77% of the power that was generated for Colorado's utility electricity in 2001 came directly from burning very dirty coal, creates a lot of greenhouse gases, a lot of carbon, a lot of other pollutants. About 20% came from natural gas, and a very small slice always from hydroelectric power, water running over dams and through dams is about 3%. Wind was at 0.1%, basically non-existent back then, and solar, utility scale solar was non-existent back then. And then we decided to compare it to more recent year, of course, to talk about what's changed since then and whether the renewable energy revolution has really changed. So look at 2023. We now have stats for how Colorado's electricity was generated for all of 2023. And the color chart is quite amazing. Coal is now down to 33% of the total. Wind is at 28%. So it's gone from nothing again in 2001 to 28% of the available power, the needed power in Colorado. And natural gas is at about 30%, but burns much cleaner than coal. People still want to get rid of it overall, and it will eventually come down to a very small slice, but still holding it about 30%. And solar is at 6% and rising quickly. We've got all kinds of utility-scale solar farms that are coming online at the end of 2023 and coming online throughout 2024 and 2025 that will bump up solar's percentage past 10% and renewables at Colorado into quite a big slice of that pie.
Now, as you just said, when you add the amount coming from natural gas and the amount coming from coal, that fossil fuels still make up close to 2/3 of our power source. But I was surprised to see wind power edging so close to becoming the single largest contributor to the electric grid.
Yes, it's really remarkable. All those, when you do get a drive out of the Front Range and head east and head north to the Wyoming border, and you see those enormous wind farms, they are making a big difference in Colorado. And you see the big utility scale solar farms out around cities and out on the plains, sometimes in growing numbers in the San Luis Valley, and that's adding the percentage to it. So what needs to keep happening to pair it with battery storage for those things that are not quite as reliable as just flipping the switch on a coal plant or a natural gas plant that can go on within a matter of minutes or a couple of hours. If the wind's not blowing, if the sun's not shining, if it's overnight and there's a sudden surge in demand for power on a hot day, you need to pair it with battery storage. And that is growing very quickly around Colorado. We're writing a lot about that. You have an array of batteries that can hold up to 8 hours, sometimes more, of a local community's power needs, all coming from renewable energy sources that are put into those batteries. So the grid is changing quickly, and we just want to let people know where we are with wind and how they can judge this political discussion about renewable energy, what should be subsidized and what should. So it's up to them. John, on your side of it, you are following some phenomena that are changing much faster than this two-decade-long change in renewable power. You're following a story that's been changing week by week in avian flu, moving into other animals, into Colorado's dairy herds. Things are not improving at the moment. Tell us what your latest is.
Yeah, so again, this is a story we've been following for a couple years now, at least. You've also done some reporting on it as well. It's this strain of H5N1 avian influenza that's been circling the globe many times over. infecting wild animals, infecting domestic poultry, and now it's really showing up quite prevalently in dairy cattle. And it's been here in Colorado for about a month, but Colorado's outbreak has recently sort of blossomed into one of the worst in the country. Now, Colorado is not a particularly big dairy-producing state. We fall outside the top 10 in terms of total amount of dairy production, but Colorado has, in the last 30 days, it has the second most cases or outbreaks of avian influenza that have been identified in dairy herds in the country. We're behind only Idaho in that. If you look going all the way back to when outbreaks were first identified, we rank fourth. So again, you know, we're sitting at 22 outbreaks among dairy herds in Colorado right now that have been identified. That's as of yesterday afternoon when I last checked. And that is, Colorado only has a little over 100 dairies to begin with. So that's more than a fifth of the dairies that we have in the state have now apparently recorded some kind of outbreak. And it's really just something that's not slowing down, at least at this point.
You've mentioned in the reporting that you've and others have done 10 outbreaks in herds in just the past week. So 10 out of 100, I mean, that's a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, obviously there's always the question of, you know, is Colorado's doing a better job of testing, or is the state really experiencing this? There's a lot still unknown about how this is exactly circulating between dairy herds. The original thought was that it was being spread from herd to herd in infected cattle, that the cattle were being moved around. There can be quite a bit of movement in the dairy industry of animals from place to place to try to optimize production, or to, you know, different places have different specialties and what kinds of animals that they raise. So that had been a thought, but there's been some studies lately in other states that suggest that there's even been outbreaks in what are called closed herds, which is herds that aren't sending animals in and out. And, you know, again, it's a little bit unclear how exactly it is spreading so much, but certainly we're seeing quite a bit of it in Colorado right now. Now, there's a couple sort of positive things, or at least things to diminish the concern here a little bit to note. One is that we're not really seeing a whole lot of concern for the health of the cattle themselves. They seem to be recovering, so we're not hearing about a lot of cattle dying as a result of being infected by bird flu. That's different than what we've seen with other animal species that have been infected by this particular strain. So that's good. So we're not seeing massive deaths of livestock. We're not seeing herds being culled in the way you would if it got into a commercial poultry farm. The second thing is that we haven't identified any cases in Colorado of people being infected because of exposure to these infected dairy herds. The state health department has been monitoring dozens, maybe even hundreds of folks, dairy workers, who have come into contact with infected animals, and has done a few tests when people show symptoms that could be flu, and they haven't found any positive cases. So we're not seeing any evidence that people are being infected. And then even beyond that, we're not seeing any evidence that people here in Colorado or in the U.S. are spreading this person to person, or that this is causing severe illness. So two really key things you want to watch for in terms of human health. Can we get it? Can we spread it? Can we get really sick from it and die from it? And so far, the answers to those questions are not something of concern. So something to monitor, not something to be super concerned about right now, unless you are working in the dairy industry, or unless you are a public health official who's trying to get a handle on this before it changes into something that is more worrisome.
And you've sometimes had a heck of a time chasing communications with the state veterinarian, who obviously is very busy, probably traveling around the state quite a bit, trying to keep a good handle on everything that's going on. When you do reach them, what are they saying in terms of what else might need to be done in state policy or state restrictions, or are we considering things that other states have done to go farther than they already have?
Yeah, so I think this is an interesting question. The USDA has already issued guidance on testing animals when they move between states. So if you're going to move an animal out of state, you need to test it to make sure that it's not infected. Or if you're moving a large number of animals, you need to test a sample size of them to make sure that you don't have infections with that herd as you're moving them across state lines. We don't have a similar rule here in Colorado. And so I think it remains to be seen whether there will be any effort to do that. There are some guidelines on movement of animals, taking care of sick animals or reporting animals that are sick and isolating. There's quarantine orders that are issued when the herds have been identified as being infected. But one thing, I was talking with an epidemiologist named Beth Carlton, who's at the Colorado School of Public Health. And one thing we were talking about with regards to this is that public health is a collaboration. It's a collaboration between health leaders, but also with the public. And we've seen since COVID sort of some of the hangovers of people just being really against this idea of shutdowns or heavy-handed public health measures that they feel like restricts movement, restricts business. And so you want to make sure that you're working in collaboration with industry, because if you end up creating rules and regulations and protocols that make it really hard for the dairy industry to function, then you've created a disincentive for the dairy industry to be honest about what's actually happening and to actually be forthcoming when they have animals that get sick, to actually sort of do the right thing and try to protect these animals or protect the other herds from spread. And so you need to kind of walk a fine balance here and not just slam it down and say, you know, there will be no movement of animals anywhere between anything in the Colorado dairy industry from now until there's no trace of H5N1 avian influenza in the United States ever again. It just becomes really hard. So you have to kind of navigate this a little bit of social engagement and, you know, a little bit of politics to make sure that you're keeping everybody on the same team and working together to try to stop this.
It seems like you'd want to recognize that among the responsible operators in the dairy industry, the last thing they want is any unfounded safety concerns about milk or dairy supply. And so that they have huge incentives to cooperate and make sure that they stay on top of everything and that they work with the state on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you haven't heard our previous items on this, pasteurized milk. So that's the kind of milk that gets sold in stores. It's been heated to kill pathogens that exist in it. Pasteurized milk is safe to drink. By all the evidence that we have right now, it's okay to drink pasteurized milk that you would buy at the stores. There is a concern about potentially getting sick from drinking raw milk that has bird flu in it. So if you are somebody who has a cow share or owns part of a dairy farm and likes to drink raw milk, that's something to keep in mind and something to be extra careful about.
Great. Well, thanks for your reporting on all of that, John. We appreciate your time on that. And thanks, everybody, for tuning again to the podcast on climate and health from the Temperature Newsletter. Next week, we are taking some time off along with everybody else who's going to be celebrating 4th of July, but we're going to have a great substitute podcast going back to a great interview with Jen Brown about a pretty remarkable heart transplant situation in Colorado with a very young recipient and a young donor and how that worked out. And in the meantime, we also suggest if you have any spare time during your vacation week to, as John mentioned at the top of the podcast, take a look at our YouTube channel and see the great event that Tatiana Flowers did with some mental health experts on making sure that Colorado and you personally are staying on top of any mental health issues that you might be concerned about. So thanks for your time, John, and thanks everybody for tuning in.
You can read more at coloradosun.com. Finally, here are a few stories that you should know about today. The political fate of the Colorado Republican Party leader is in jeopardy after the party leader faltered Tuesday during the state primary. Earlier this year, state party chair Dave Williams made the controversial decision to endorse candidates in the primary, and he used party money to support his own campaign. Williams was soundly beaten in the 5th Congressional District primary, and of the 18 candidates the state party endorsed, 14 of them lost. Now, some of Colorado's leading Republicans are calling for Williams to step down. Everything's coming up computer chips in Colorado Springs. On Wednesday, a second company in the city scored big in the federal incentive program to lure chip manufacturing back to the United States. Entegris was awarded $75 million as part of the CHIPS and Science Act. It is building a 130,000-square-foot manufacturing plant on land that once housed an old Hewlett-Packard factory. In January, Microchip Technology received $90 million to grow and modernize its fabrication plant in Colorado Springs and hire another 400 workers. Colorado is having an average water year, but looking ahead, climate experts say much of the state could fall into drought conditions this summer and struggle to find relief. Those who monitor Colorado's water conditions say the state's very average snowpack has officially melted away, and reservoir levels are at 94%, while precipitation was at exactly 100%. Heat, however, has been on the rise. One state climatologist said a strong monsoon would be really helpful, but it's looking like that is not likely, and it's going to be a pretty rough summer. For more information on all of these stories, visit our website, coloradosun.com. And don't forget to tune in again next time. Now, a quick message from our team.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening. My name is Jason Blevins. I'm the outdoors writer here at the Colorado Sun, co-founder of the Colorado Sun. I'm on the weekly podcast with David Krause every Monday. And I also write a weekly newsletter. Comes out every Thursday. It's called The Outsider. Take a look at each issue has sort of early glimpses of stories. I got stuff on housing, high country business, high country culture, public lands, public land managers, kind of just about anything kind of interesting and happening on the Western Slope. Try to get into it. Ski industry stuff. I invite you to come check it out. It's one of the many newsletters we have at the Colorado Sun. Head to coloradosun.com/join and become a member and support the Colorado Sun. Appreciate you guys listening. Thanks.